Uklamach lutis miau, mama femti Charlotte Cote, histak shitla zumaas, nuchanolhatin, Vancouver Island. My Tsishat name is Lotis Miyalt. It means carrying thunder. And my English name is Charlotte, and I'm from the Tsishat Nation on Vancouver Island, and it's part of the larger nation of Nuchanolth on the west coast of Vancouver Island in British Columbia.
As a professor at the University of Washington in Seattle, Charlotte teaches courses on Native people in the Northwest Coast and Indigenous food sovereignty. She wrote Spirit of Our Wailing Ancestors, Revitalizing Macaw and Nuchanolth Traditions, and her next book, A Drum in One Hand, A Sockeye in the Other, Stories of Indigenous Food Sovereignty from the Northwest Coast, is set to be published in January of 2022.
The biological diversity along in the Northwest Coast created this abundance of foods in this area that we define as a Northwest Coast area and where are my people, the Nuchanolth people, are. And it created an abundance of foods which we and other coastal nations harvested by fishing, gathering, hunting, with respect to the Nuchanolth and them, our relatives, the Macaw in Washington State. We hunted whales as well. We gathered, we cultivated plants, we cultivated and gathered medicines. The harvesting, cultivation, preparation, sharing, and trading of our foods was conducted within our own prescribed cultural values based on respect, reciprocity, interdependency, and ecological sustainability. And our food systems functioned in a very healthy and interdependent relationship with our environment and was maintained through the active participation in our traditional land and food systems. The kinds of foods that were available to us and the quantities of foods that were available to us depended on that symbiotic relationship that we had to our environment and keeping that relationship strong. For Tsishat, our traditional diets were marine-based. A lot of our diet, our foods came from the ocean because we had a territory that expanded from the, on the west coast of Vancouver Island, up through Barkley Sound, through the Alberni Inlet to Tsumaas, to this river. And I say Tsumaas really is a river that runs through us because it's like the life vein given, bringing us nutritious foods. Following colonization, we were forced to make our permanent village on the Tsumaas River, and we became more and more dependent on the foods that we had within that river, and one of them is sockeye salmon, or miat in my language. It still to this day is the most important food in my community and on the Northwest Coast. You can't talk about the Northwest Coast without talking about salmon. I mean, we are the land of salmon and cedar, as many people say. And so when I was writing this book, I was talking to my family about it, and one of my relatives says, you know, the motto that we have in our community is, and I use this in my book, he says, a happy Tsishat has a drum in one hand and a sockeye in the other. And I love that because it really speaks to who we are as salmon people. And salmon was and still is at the heart of our cultural identities. As more and more people are thinking about this concept of food sovereignty, that is the right to eat, to produce these kinds of foods that are connected to your cultural identity, as well as to eat nutritious food. So the right to be in an economic situation where you can afford to eat good and healthy foods. A lot of the unhealthiness that we see in our communities today, a lot of these health issues that we see were and still are connected to how settler colonialism impacts us. You know, when we talk about Indigenous food sovereignty, we can't look at it, we can't fix it until we really examine it through that settler colonialism lens. And then only then will we be able to move forward and start really thinking about our health in a very different way, especially as it connects to our cultures and identities. And it's not just us. I mean, it's the larger global population that has been being fed these industrial foods, because the people who create or produce these foods are dictating the global food regime. So we have those kinds of foods sitting in our markets, sitting in the, you know, in the stores. These companies put millions of dollars into finding that bliss point in their foods. So when you do put your hand in those Doritos, you know, and take one out, you don't want just one, you want the whole bag. And they do that on purpose. We become conditioned to believe those are the foods we should eat. We start forgetting about these very important foods that are still around us. You know, the store outside our back door. I love that concept. It's very hard, and I tell my students this in my food sovereignty class, it's very hard to think about having a relation to something that's wrapped in plastic, in a container that you get out of a cooler in a grocery store. It's very different when you're out on the water with your relatives or your community members, and you're bringing in that net with all of those salmon, and you're standing with your relatives or members of your community and honoring those salmon that have come up that riverway to give themselves to you. It's a very different way of experiencing a relationship with your food. And then eating and sharing usually also is accompanied by your traditional songs or songs around, you know, salmon or around your traditional foods. Or they're being shared at these large events called potlatches on the Northwest Coast, where we come together for various reasons, but it's always around food. Food is at the center and at the core of our communities. And so it really is important that we decolonize not just, you know, our lands, not just our community, you know, our communities and how we engage in our communities, but decolonize our diet, decolonize our taste buds, and re-indigenize the foods that we put on our table.
As Native communities across Turtle Island work to indigenize their food systems, they're doing so with adaptation to the times, because
there's so many things that have changed over the years. The federal policies in both the United States and Canada impacted us greatly when our children were taken away and placed in boarding schools and didn't have the opportunity to decide what to eat. So, you know, many of them were fed inadequate diets. And, you know, in very recent years, we also found out through this report that came out through an article by Dr. Ian Mosby about how some of the children were even part of a study that was never consented to by that child, or those children never consented to by those parents, where certain children were fed certain foods within the boarding schools, and many of them purposely not given enough foods to keep them healthy. And so they were starving these children in order to conduct these experiments around nutritional value of processed foods. And so when you are exposed to that and you're exposed to those kinds of foods for long periods of time, you start disassociating from the foods that are your traditional foods or first foods that are healthy and nutritious. And you start getting programmed to believe these are the kinds of foods you should eat.
In her research on Indigenous food sovereignty initiatives, one of the projects that Charlotte has been following and included in her forthcoming book
is a garden that my sister Gail built in my community. And the garden is providing these wonderful foods, nutritious foods to our communities. What is even more significant about what Gail did was where she situated that garden. That garden is placed on the former lands of a boarding school site. It's actually right in an area that was, and I say this word loosely, playground, because nobody played in the boarding schools, but in what was defined as a playground area. And the reason why she cultivated it there was because she said, you know, we need to heal, which is why I want to grow these foods, you know, so that they can be, you know, accompaniment to our healthy salmon and some of these seafoods that we also have stayed connected to. But she said, we need to heal, but that land needs to heal too. That land needs to heal. That land felt the pain that those children were feeling in that school. It needed to heal. That was so profound to me when she said that, you know, because it didn't make sense to me when she told me she was going to cultivate her garden on those lands of that former boarding school site. It's a boarding school that's situated right in the middle of our community. They basically took a big part of our community or of our lands and placed a boarding school there, put a 6-foot-high chain link fence around that school, and then took kids out of our community, put them in that school on the other side of that chain link fence so that you could see your house, but you couldn't go to it. And so I was just really surprised when she said she was going to grow it there. And she says, no, we've got to re-indigenize that space and bring it back to its cultural sustenance, to bring that cultural sustenance back into that space.
As more Indigenous communities work to steward the landscape and their local food system, they can connect with each other so that producers can
develop that kind of economy where it's trading. It's trading with other harvesters and trading with other Indigenous communities so that we get out of that capitalist game and start really focusing on the way we used to be, how important these trade networks were for making sure that we had diversity of foods within our communities, and that diversity then, you know, creating those healthy living environments and providing nutritional foods that otherwise wouldn't be part of your community. I mean, it was important. The trade network along the Northwest coast was really significant in how foods were traded up and down the coast. It is about staying connected to our traditional foods, but it's also about reconnecting to our healthy selves again.